name's Ryan Miller, and for the past 15 years, I've helped hundreds of people to raise millions of dollars for their funds and for their startups. If you're serious about raising money, launching your business, or taking your life to the next level, this show will give you the answers so that you too can enjoy your pursuit of making billions. Let's get into it.
What's one thing successful people have in common? Well, if you're asking me, they've all had great mentors. My next guest is a hedge fund mentor, and he's dedicated his entire career to helping people to know the best way to launch a hedge fund so that they too can enjoy their pursuit of making billions. Let's get into it. Hey, welcome to another episode of Making Billions. I'm your host, Ryan Miller, and today I have my dear friend, Kevin Fu. Kevin is the founder and CEO at Repool. It's a fintech company helping emerging hedge fund managers to launch, scale, and manage their investment funds. As a 2021 Y Combinator graduate, he's raised capital from all the elite investors like Brex, Mercury, Flexpoint, Matrix, and more. So what this means is that Kevin understands how to launch and scale hedge funds and is about to give you and I a masterclass on how to do the same. So Kevin, welcome to the show, man.
Hey, Ryan. Yeah, it's really good to be here as someone who's listened to the show quite a few times myself. It's fun to be on finally myself.
Yeah, man. Well, thank you. We've been fortunate to be in the top 2% in the world, and it's all because of amazing guests like you. So let's jump right into it. Tell me a little bit about just 30 seconds. What does Repool do? And then we'll jump into some beginner advice.
Yeah, well, you know, I think you gave a good preview, but in short, Repool is a venture-backed digital-first hedge fund solutions provider. So we provide modern back office solutions to help emerging and established fund managers alike to be more successful, drive better investor relationships, and overall have better outcomes with services like end-to-end fund launch, standalone fund admin, and also fund software that can plug into an existing back office stack.
Brilliant. Awesome, man. You're essentially launching hedge funds and as well as back office services and administrative and all that stuff. So that's brilliant. The end-to-end stack. I love it. You've been a beginner. I've been a beginner before. Let's hit them right between the eyes. In your opinion, starting out, taking all your knowledge, what are some of the pieces of advice you can give to people who are just starting out in their hedge fund journey or any of that? What would you tell someone starting out to get some early points on the board?
Yeah, definitely. And for context, you know, at this point over the last few years since we've begun operating, we've worked primarily with U.S. emerging managers. And in particular, we focus on open-ended funds. A lot of our clients have the traditional fund manager background. You know, they were on some desk, but actually a lot of our clients have a quote unquote non-traditional background, right? They're just a talented trader in their own right. Maybe they're a wealth advisor launching their first fund. Maybe they're someone who's been trading on their own for 15 years and is otherwise, you know, some sort of other white collar professional. But in short, we've seen a lot. And so I think the number one thing that comes to mind for me is even though fund managers are generally very brilliant at raising, very similar to a lot of startups, they often kind of skip certain steps that are really important. And I think the big one is to actually make sure that prior to launching, you have true, hard committed capital from real investors and a really solid game plan on the multiple kind of variations of, you know, expected case, worst case, and best case. So many people really don't actually go as far as to firm the commitment. You know, they'll have these conversations with prospective investors and they'll keep things very soft. Like, oh, I'm thinking of launching a fund. You know me, I'm great. You think I'm great. Would you be interested in investing? And the investor says yes. And then they come and they talk to lawyers and fund service providers. They go, oh, I've got these soft commits. But those are not actually commitments, right? And raising capital is really challenging. Obviously, Ryan, you've been really successful at it. I'm sure your viewers have learned a lot from you. But there's just a big difference between someone that you're friendly with or even close with in kind of floating an idea or talking casually and making the explicit ask. So going as far as to make it almost as real as if you had the fund and saying, hey, you know, can we handshake on this, or getting some sort of literal LOI, email confirmation, telling them like, this is real, I'm going to do it. What are you in for, you know, on this timeline? I think that's the big thing that comes to mind for me.
Brilliant. So just making sure you get real commitments from real investors. None of this, if you build it, they will come. That's very old school. And the hit rate, as it coming out of Y Combinator, you would know, they knock that out of you, is just saying, nope, you got to iterate. You got to get real commitments from people and make sure that whatever you're putting in the market, people want to pay you for it. And so when you have that, man, that is powerful. Now, you and I, we've spoken offline. We've known each other for a little bit now. And I'm curious, helping people launch hedge funds, what have you found as far as like metrics? What advice can you give people as far as sharing financial information? Maybe you can speak on that for beginners.
Yeah, I mean, I think the first step, it's almost pre-metrics, is to understand who you're raising from, right? So there are levels to the game, and it's not actually that important that you're in a particular level. It's that you play the right game at the level you're in. So a very common manifestation of this that I think is a mismatch, and it affects the metrics too, is people say things like, oh, like, I just need to get up and running. I have this amazing strategy. Once I actually have this marketable track record, then I'll for sure raise from, you know, XYZ type of institution allocator. But one, those actual relationships don't exist and they don't know how to get in front of them, which kind of ties back to what we were just talking about. But two, like what those investors will care about and what you need to be prepared to be sophisticated about in discussing your strategy and a prospective allocation and metrics is very different than if you're raising from, say, friends and family or something in between, like regional family offices that don't necessarily look at hedge funds or private funds in, like, you know, kind of the most common financial hubs. And so essentially, I think you really want to tailor your metrics to your audience, which sounds really obvious, but I think it's something that often doesn't happen. And you know, first impressions are kind of everything. If you walk into your first true allocator fundraising meeting and you blow it, you know, it's not dead forever, but you've kind of burned that prospective raise for a pretty long time. I think at the most sophisticated level, if you can and you have any sort of marketable track record legally, being able to speak to how correlated it is, I think is very important. That arguably to me is one of the most important is you need to have a really strong view on how you fit in to an allocator's overall strategy, right? Are you long short or are you something very esoteric or anything in between? And then derivative from that, you should at least be able to speak to things like your beta and your Sharpe and ideally have some sort of backtesting and forward-looking forecast. And then as a derivative, right, it's not just about the metrics themselves historically. It's about your ability to convince the allocator that the strategy is durable over time from a scale perspective or what we might call capacity, right? Like, does your $5 million strategy work at 100 mil? The guy cutting the $50 million check doesn't care if it works at five, if you can't convince him it works at 100. And you need to have sophisticated answers for how you will defend against fee creep, how you'll be able to, you know, scale a strategy that maybe isn't trading on the most liquid items, et cetera, or, you know, what types of instruments you'll add as the strategy grows to maintain your target allocations and overall kind of return profile. And then also through macro trends, right? I think especially the last few years, investing in allocators, just everyone, we're just more short-sighted. I don't mean that in a bad way. I just think everyone is more cognizant of the fact that things move faster now, right? Just look at average holding period for ETFs as an example. Allocators used to hold position 7, 8, 9, 10 years. That was the average holding period. Today, I think the average holding period for average investor of a ETF is something like 2 to 3 years. And, you know, allocators are more sophisticated, but that's translated them too. They're more willing to make redemptions more quickly. They're more willing to rebalance their own portfolio. I mean, they're literally a fund manager in their own right. It's just that instead of investing into underlying assets, they invest into funds that give them aggregate exposure. So anyways, you know, you really need to have thought through all sorts of various hypotheticals on what happens if the risk-free rate goes up. What happens if it goes down? What about in either of those two cases, if it's slower than you think, on pace than you think, faster than what you think, you know, how does your strategy enter in any possible situation? Those are the questions that sophisticated allocators will ask, and you just need to have answers for all of them.
I love that. And so really wrapping your arms around the macros and just thinking it through. So, you know, it does help. As I'm listening to what you're saying, I've done this. So I run a fund, and part of the things that I do is I just try to flip the table. Somebody's pitching me and I'm really going to grind them, but not in a way to be mean, but really understand what it is they're trying to ask me to do. I'm going to want to know exactly what you said. Hey, interest rates are moving around. What's going to happen to your fund, whether it's private equity, real estate, whatever? What's going to happen if we've got, you know, 2 points, 3 points, like where I'm always finding the edges. And so a big part of pitching is you're going to find a lot of allocators are going to ask you questions to find your edges and to say, okay, what happens if it raises 1 point? Okay, nothing. Okay, what happens if it raises 3, 5, 10? Right. And they're just going to say, how far does this go? And so even though we're not going to get a 10 point raise in the Fed funds rate, but what they're trying to do, even if the question sounds ridiculous, please understand that investors are trying to find where does it drop off, exactly what you had mentioned, Kevin. So I love that. Now, also, it's not enough just to get points on the board. While that is good, you can still do some stupid stuff, otherwise known as rookie mistakes. What's some stuff that you've seen now that you've been in this for a little while? What advice can you give to beginners on how to avoid just getting smoked on their first fund?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, hopefully generate good returns is step one.
Don't lose money. Yeah,
don't lose money, right? Well, but putting that aside, right, I think there's probably two things that come to mind. One is like just more of a philosophical point, and that's to temper your expectations and then have a plan. And I guess that's just thematically in line with what I've started to beat a dead horse on. But most people just are less successful than they think they will be. That doesn't just happen in hedge funds. It happens in businesses. It happens in every aspect of life. You'll probably raise less money than you think, and it will take longer than you think, and it'll be harder than you think. And how not to lose, like if you don't actually contemplate that reality and how you're going to feel, how you're going to react, what your game plan is, if you don't end up in the happier half of the spectrum, that's where a lot of people who are otherwise really smart, and I see this as a tech founder all the time, you know, you just basically never seriously asked, will I continue on? Do my economics, does my runway support this worst case scenario? Or do you get kind of caught with your pants down and then you're almost not even sure what to do, or you're just caught off guard? Obviously, when things actually happen, it'll never be as you plan, but just really try and plan. I mean, that's kind of it. And planning is free. And it's easier than trading in some senses. Most people just are not as thorough as they could be. And just recognize this is a really hard game, right? There are people with incredible backgrounds, incredible pedigrees, incredible track records that go out and try and start funds and they fail. And then there are people who have much worse of all those things and succeed. So it's not just this pure play. Everything that you do has some sort of point system and we put the points together and then people succeed sequentially relative to, you know, their absolute value. This is an art. This is a science, right? And I think, Ryan, you know, we were just talking about this. You're a great example of that. You've really killed it at Pentium and built an asset management business that I think many people with quote unquote better backgrounds would be super envious of. And that's incredible. But it also shows that this is about a lot of different factors, not just things that you think are true or false, right?
Thank you for watching. If you've made it this far, we must be friends. So don't forget to like, subscribe, and click that notification button. Now, let's get back to the show.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
AI is changing the game of business. Will you be on the winning team? I'm Jordan Wilson, the host of the Everyday AI podcast, and your coach to help you learn the X's and O's of AI. Artificial intelligence isn't just a new player in the game, it's a new sport altogether. So if you don't quickly put AI into play, your competitors will run up the score. I've spent my whole life building winning teams, from coaching basketball to working with big players like Nike and Jordan Brand. My next move? Helping you win with Everyday AI. Listen wherever you get your podcasts or on everydayaipodcast.com. Let's tap into AI together and put points on the board.
So that's the philosophical point. I think the practical one is understand the problems you need to solve. Solve those and don't solve problems you don't have. I think a lot of fund managers are out there obsessing over things. And I think if I had to guess, I think it's just that like you want to feel like you're in control. And so you try and solve problems that you can identify. And it kind of gives you this feeling like you're doing something structured and intelligent. But it's kind of like focusing on what doesn't matter. Again, I'll do these company analogies because I am in tech and am working on a venture-backed startup and see this. It's like founders often go solve problems that are not even close to the highest order problems. So they're busy and they're doing things and they look like they're doing things, but it's just not actually even close to the most important thing they should be doing. So in the context of funds, it's often thinking towards like, oh, like this is how I need to structure the fund today, because when I'm 100 million and I'm raising from these international family offices, I need to have like my tax situation figured out. So I have my like my Cayman blocker vehicle in play. And I have this like super prestigious accounting firm like KPMG doing my audit. And it's like, no, man, you're trying to raise 15 million. You can't afford those. And those are problems that don't actually exist. So solve them and hope that you have the luxury of having those problems. But at worst, it's just a delay because you're solving things that literally don't matter. And it also causes you, I think, to just lose time. Time's really valuable. That's time you could be refining your pitch. That's time you could be getting your fund up and running. That's time you could be refining your strategy. I see this really, really, really often. So I think it's just really have an honest assessment of who you are and where you are and what you think is realistic. Maybe the final iteration of this I'll see is a lot of people peer compare. They'll say something like, hey, I have like Ryan's background and Ryan's got like a billion of assets under management. So like clearly I will too. Therefore, I need to approach launching my fund like how Ryan would launch his sixth fund. And you see this actually more often with institutional folks like, oh, my buddy who was a PM at Citadel left and was seeded with 100 mil and he spent 2 million on his launch. It's like, do you have a seed investor for 100 mil lined up? If not, who cares? Go solve your own battle. And so you should definitely learn. There's a lot to learn from other people. There's a lot of advice, but just really understand your truth and go solve for that.
Yeah, that's brilliant. So don't compare. That's just good life advice. That's the enemy of happiness or joy. But also, yeah, really have, I think what you're talking about, I'm totally putting words in your mouth, but a little self-awareness and just appreciate where you're at. Have a vision of where you want to go, obviously. But knowing where you're at and addressing the issues in front of you is so important. And I've seen this in, and honestly, in my opinion, to echo the brilliant advice you just said, that would be a leadership problem. And sometimes you got to lead yourself. And if you're constantly chasing things that you don't need to be chased while ignoring the immediate, and look, I've done it. I'm a strategic thinker. So I'm always playing the long game and moving the chess pieces around. And lucky for me, I have great partners that bring me back and say, look, we love your strategic mind. we got stuff we got to deal with right in front of us. And so that is a real thing that Kevin's talking about. Folks is saying, sure, if you want to be in the Billy Club, right? You want to manage a billion AUM and above? Great. Sure. Go for it. Absolutely. But what about your first million? And I would say the grind, and Kevin, you may have a different opinion, but I would say your first milestone is just get to 25 million. If you can get to 25 million, you can have enough fees to start paying a couple salaries and really just stabilize your fund. And so your goal is not to be like, I'm going to go crazy. It's just saying iterate and keep raising the bar. So get to that place where you have enough fees in your hedge fund where you can actually manage it. Now, the beauty of hedge funds, we obviously have one, is their op costs are very nice. They're very affordable. So we definitely like hedge funds. But to that point, just to land this plane, let's just make sure that you are managing the fund that you have as well as the fund that you're going to be. And so it's a bit of a ping pong game, but you can't neglect one for the other. And so Kevin is just, you're spot on, brother. You got to make sure that you also deal with the fund that you've got and not just solely work on the fund that you know you will be. So I absolutely love it. So as we turn the corner, let's talk about the market, right? Especially hedge funds. You help a lot of people launch hedge funds. What are you seeing out there? Where's the market at right now?
Yeah. So I think one of the interesting trends that is quite good for, you know, what I assume to be the types of listeners to this show is smaller funds are definitely on the up in the cycle. I think markets of every kind are cyclical, and actually allocator behavior towards what size and types of hedge funds are no exception. So both the asset types that are favorable and in vogue and most popular with allocators, as well as the size of funds, tend to cycle. Right now, I think we've come off a huge boom cycle, ZIRP, everyone kind of knows what's been going on, where these traditional asset managers have become extraordinarily bloated, right? They're just massive now. And that's because it was easy to generate returns and it was very low risk because there was no interest rate. So it made sense to just pile into who you knew worked and they could still generate reasonable returns. But in this new world, which is potentially going to persist indefinitely, in fact, I think most people think ZIRP is the exception, not the normal that we'll return to. It's just really hard to generate interesting alpha when you've got many, many billions under management. And so the trend you see is the asset managers get very famous and a reputation off of when they're small, people pile in and then they don't generate interesting returns and they kind of coast on their reputation. And I think that's just the eternal battle, but it has gotten to the point that it's so severe that I think people are actively starting to look towards smaller funds again. A lot of allocators have specific goals around allocating to emerging managers. They're being more aggressive about making many small-sized investments distributed against many small funds rather than taking that same pool of capital and give it to a large fund. So if you can, and this ties back to the last answer in terms of things that value, if you can get your track record out and run it for long enough time while the market conditions are favorable for a small manager, I think right now is a macro moment that will persist for at least several years where you're probably more likely to get in front of these institutional allocators and family offices and high net worth individuals than you would have 3, 4, or 5 years ago. So, you know, one of the things you can do is instead of solving for problems you don't have, like the one thing you can't just big brain or pay money for is time and market track record. You know, if you in the next 2, 3, 4 years can have a vehicle that's been up and running, has strong metrics that achieve your strategy and whatever investment objective, and then in this particular market condition, you can get out and take that track record in front of allocators, I think it's a good time to be a small manager.
Brilliant. So good time to be a small manager. And I'm sure you know this, but there actually is research, folks, that confirms what Kevin says is, in fact, when you aggregate smaller funds, they tend to outperform the larger ones. So not only that is not an opinion piece by Kevin, this is actually a research documented fact that smaller funds do tend in aggregate to outperform the larger ones on an absolute basis. Now, where do you see it going? So right now, people are liking small funds. Personally, I think we're just entering the golden era of alternatives. We'll see if I'm right. But I think a lot of people are starting to wake up to that's literally this whole show is on alternative investments, entrepreneurship, and pretty much any kind of fund that's out there. But that being said, that's great and all. But people pay allocators like myself to look around corners. So I'm curious, just an opinion, what are you seeing out there? What do you see in the market? Where do you think it's going?
I don't know that it's just alts that are about to have a go moment. I think it's just uncorrelated and more unique strategies, right? So if everyone piles into the same alt strategy, then I don't think that's interesting anymore. I think what it is, there is so much better tooling now and technology that has caused publicly available low risk investment opportunities to rise that synthetically proxy what you would traditionally only get from a hedge fund, right? So think of all these ETFs that are arising or these alternative asset investing platforms where instead of paying a 2 and 20, there are really complicated indices that you know, give you exposure to instruments that you could have only ever gotten exposure to in a private fund, except for like now you pay a 10 basis point expense ratio instead of giving some manager, you know, whatever, 150 basis points and a performance fee. And on top of that, the liquidity of the instrument is way higher because hedge funds are, in private funds generally, are more restricted. And so in order, that's going from the most commoditizable strategies first to the hardest. And maybe 100 years from now, private funds won't exist because we'll have figured out ways to synthetically proxy more liquid, low cost alternatives of all of them. But my point is, you know, alternatives are interesting because you still can't get exposure to alternatives unless you go and invest in a fund that gives you exposure to alternatives. But long short, man, like that's a hard game because you can kind of do that through much lower cost options. It doesn't mean you can't succeed there, but it's about having an edge. So maybe what I'd refine is you have to have a view on how your strategy or investment objective is different and where it slots in. Like, what are you giving an investor and allocator that they can't get without you? Alternatives are a great way to do that. Real estate's a great way to do that. It could be crypto, but it also could be regular, plain vanilla equity, long biased. If you have a really interesting thesis that is not expressed in the market otherwise, quantitative is much harder, as an example, to replicate through ETFs because of a variety of technical challenges and trading restrictions. So you just need to really be able to understand where your edge is, Ryan, like you said. And it doesn't have to just be alts. I just think alts are a more obvious example of an edge implicitly because they're alts, right? So I definitely agree with that. And that's one observation. The other, I think, is that there are just more funds and it's also there are just more investing opportunities. And that ties back to what we just said. So as a result, you need to find ways to find your own edge and be differentiated. And I do think there will be a bias towards funds that drive a better LP partnership, right? If nowadays there's 10,000 long short private funds I can get access to, and they're all, many of them are very similar at least, and I have the luxury of choice, well, then where I'm going to start splitting my decision is who gives me maybe better terms, who gives me better transparency, which funds are easier to work with. So I do think technology is really having a heyday, and that's not just to talk our own book. I mean, that's literally part of the thesis behind why we started Repool is we see that. But it's literally already happening in many of these private fund asset classes. Venture is probably the most progressive here by nature of what they do. I think that kind of makes sense. They make bets on the future of the world and where things are going. But there's all these really interesting venture tools that augment your back office now or more digital first fund admins that give investors easier onboarding, more transparency, digital first redemptions, capital calls, KYC, AML, communication, data room, CRM. And so as an LP, it's just easier. And so if I have two same funds and one of them just gives me a way better experience, then I think LPs are demonstrably picking that. So because there's more choice now and because there's more funds, you want to, in general, index towards driving a favorable LP experience. I think it is harder to justify two things. One is really restrictive bad terms. Like it's really hard to pull off like a five-year lockup now because for every five-year lockup, there's some fund that does the same thing that has a three-year lockup. So I'm going to go over there. The other is the experience, right? If you're a fund where I'm still operating entirely out of spreadsheets, it's really hard to understand at a glance what your, you know, investment portfolio is to the extent you're sharing it or to subscribe or interact or get my capital out. I have to send a ton of emails, make a lot of phone calls. If your services force is offshore and there's a literal language barrier, those are things that were common even just 5-10 years ago, but I think are rapidly becoming less tolerable. So making sure that you pick service providers that represent your fund in the right way, that is attractive to LPs, I think it's just attractive. It's just everything. We just always pick the better way. You see that in every form of technology ever. So private funds are no different. So those are the two big trends I would point out.
Yeah, I love that. And that that goes back into my ethos just as a company at Pantheon at our fund is we do very much obsess over LP experience. For those who aren't in funds, limited partner LP is just your investors. And so really just reducing the friction. So I use the analogy or the example of Amazon where they have those speakers in your house and literally you can shout out into the sky, order me hot sauce, and it shows up. Like talk about a frictionless experience. And so that is a great lesson in any kind of business. Now, I don't want to just pepper general platitudes in business over everything. But what I am saying is think about the end user and their experience with you and reducing friction or sometimes things that slow it down or frustrate or whatever it is. Anything that gets in the way of a very smooth process, whatever that is, can really help you. And I think as long as you agree, and that's what we're saying is, I think in the future, funds who do prioritize LP experience and using companies and administrators that really help to smooth out that experience, I think those are the ones who are really going to get the LP capital. Would you agree?
Yeah, look, it's not rocket science, right? It's just the simple question, would I like things to be harder or would I like things to be easier? And that's just how we all behave in any aspect of our lives. So yeah, definitely.
100%. Thank you. So, you know, as we round third base, a lot of people come to this show making billions to look for competitive advantage. And so speaking of prioritizing experience, one of the things that we do is we take pride in providing those competitive advantages so people's edges can expand. And so, Kevin, with all of your experience, you've done a lot of cool stuff. You've raised from very impressive people. You've been through Y Combinator, which is impressive by itself as well. You've done a lot of stuff. And my man, you're just getting started. So what can you do, looking back and leveraging your experience, what competitive advantages can you provide for our listeners today?
Yeah, I think in the context of private funds generally, not even just hedge funds, even though hedge funds are primarily our focus, one actionable insight that, you know, we obviously can also help with is considering a 506C offering, which is a relatively newer instrument. I think, Ryan, you've done this for at least some of your funds, and I know it's been great for you. We've talked about it before, but a lot of people aren't familiar with this. So to just give like a quick brief education, right? One of the considerations you have to have when you have a private fund is what type of securities offering are you doing? And in this context, it's not about you investing in securities. It's about the fact that when you bring on an investor, that very action, regardless of your structure, you are by definition selling them a security. And so there are regulations that regulate that. And commonly there are restrictions around solicitation that most viewers or listeners rather are probably familiar with. You probably have some vague impression that you can't just go screaming down the street about your hedge fund. You actually can't even have a website in most cases. And then folks need to meet certain financial standards. And so some form of that has been around for a really long time. A very new offering, especially in a slow-moving 100-year-old industry such as private funds, is an offering type called 506C. It's really only been around since post-Dodd-Frank. I think the year is 2014 is when it was ratified or whatever you call it, introduced or passed. And what the offering type does is it allows you to generally solicit. So you could literally run down the street screaming about your hedge fund. That probably isn't the best strategy, but more seriously, you could run ads. You could have a publicly available website that literally talks about your strategy. You can just show your returns to people. You basically have the opportunity to, if you're good at marketing, or even if you're not, just dramatically increase the surface area of potential allocators you can get in front of. And that can be a really, really big help for an emerging manager. You know, if you say, hey, I have the ability to raise, you know, 4 million. And Ryan earlier said 25 million is the magic threshold. I would definitely agree. I think 10 is around where you start to be like shelf stable though. Like you can't hire a bunch of people, but like at least you're paying your bills and it's like a full-time job. Yeah. And so, you know, I've seen managers literally raise half or more than half of their funds through the solicitation side. Now, the trade-off is you have to verify that those investors are accredited to a higher standard. Normally in a traditional offering, you give them a subscription booklet. It's definitely esoteric and complicated, but it is a self-attestation at the end of the day. So they just check some box or a series of boxes, and that's the extent of it. In a C, you actually need to verify it. So another reason it's relatively unknown is when it was first introduced, it was kind of like, okay, well, what does that mean? And then how do we do it? And originally it was, you had to get like, investors would go get a letter from their lawyer or CPA, literally attesting that they were accredited. And that was very painful. I mean, asking investors to do that is not fun. And a lot of investors are just simply not going to do it. It's not about whether they are or aren't accredited. It's just, speaking of easier versus harder, that's a big hoop to jump through. And a lot of allocators are privacy minded and just don't want to open the kimono, regardless of whether what's behind it is good or bad. Nowadays, there are providers like us, and we're certainly not the only ones, but I think our offering of it in conjunction with fund admin, fund launch, and standalone back office is relatively unique. But we have digital first selves where we make it really easy to collect the appropriate information, tax returns, statements, whatever, commensurate to the means by which they claim to be accredited. And then there's still a real human on our side verifying it. And then we'll produce like a letter that should be suitable for regulators. And in short, what we do is we totally abstract away the pain of verifying that someone's accredited for the manager. And we make it as easy as humanly possible for the LP. And now you gain in return the ability to generally solicit. And there's no application process. It's what's called a self-executing exemption. You know, I always use the analogy. It's like driving down the highway. You don't need to ask someone's permission to do it, but you better be under the speed limit if someone looks. And that's the same with 506C. So you can just do this right now, but everyone has to go through that higher standard. And I think there's been a lot of fund managers who have seen huge payoff from it. Allows you to raise more capital more quickly. And that can be a life or death difference. Or it can also just be a time to launch difference. And again, as we said before, the one thing you can't structure or pay your way out of is time in market, time building that track record. If that lets you launch today instead of 2 years from now, that is 2 years of track record. And as a reference point, allocators usually want three when they're sophisticated. So now you are literally only 1 year instead of 3 years away from potentially being able to pitch really serious allocators and blow your fund up. So I think it's incredibly valuable. Now, look, there are obviously trade-offs. You know, the types of LPs who are going to come in, their behavior, especially when you lose money since you don't have a pre-existing relationship with them, they may be more demanding. They may be more testy. They may be more flighty and more willing to leave when things go bad. But for a lot of managers, I think it's a trade worth considering. And obviously, it's not like you have to make this the entirety of your LP base. So I would say that's the big one. I think it's novel. I think a lot of people don't know about it. And I would really encourage people to think about that if it's appropriate for them.
Yeah, brilliant. What's another piece of advice? So 506C, it's relatively new, about a 10 years or so since it's been passed. It allows you to openly solicit versus the old school way, which was maybe your dad's golf buddies. So for those of us, and I'm certainly one of them, that may not have grown up in that environment and had a different experience and not have rich friends from your parents, then this 506C might be something where people with non-traditional backgrounds who maybe don't have, you know, everybody to fill their fund that came out of Citadel, like you said, or somewhere, 506C can be an absolute game changer for them. The second thing, what would you say for a competitive advantage that you can give people?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think if I had to pick a second one, it is a little redundant, but I really don't think it can be expressed enough in enough different ways. It's to go get in the market, do things. And then the actual insight is like, figure out the fastest path to test the waters. I'll do a startup analogy here since I didn't earlier. I see this all the time with YC founders and venture-backed founders, you know, coming from the best schools, from the best companies. They'll do things when they raise, because startup founders, we just like fund managers, we also need to raise from really sophisticated allocators. They'll say things like, well, I need to first raise from, you know, XYZ prestigious VC. And that's the first allocator I'm going to take. I'm not going to take friends and family, or I need to leave room for them, or I need a plan for that. And it's actually completely wrong. And a lot of great VCs and programs like YC help beat that out of you, or try to. It's a very intuitive thing, I think, to feel, but it's wrong. And I think the same is true for private funds. It's all about momentum. It's about getting out there. So you are better off if you can get money from friends and family, take it and get in the market and start building that track record. And then when you go to the serious allocators, you're probably better off anyways, because you say, look, these people already gave me money and I'm already operating. And that's almost always more attractive looking and more legitimate and more useful than if you're like, hey, you're going to be the first one in, right? So just get moving. Don't trip. Don't go so fast you do something stupid, but don't have any sort of like, I need to wait for this future hypothetical event that hasn't yet happened, whatever type of thing. The other thing that's related to that is, and we talked about this at the very beginning, but I can't emphasize enough, like figure out how to synthetically proxy a real raise. Don't just handshake, get a letter of intent, make a contract. That contract doesn't have to literally even do anything legally, in the sense that obviously, like, if an LP doesn't give you money, what are you going to do? Sue your LP? Of course not, right? But like, get them so that you're 99% sure the money is actually going to come in. And it's not just a useful exercise because you have the confidence that you actually launch with the seed capital you think you will, but it's a really great test of actually understanding if what you're putting into the market is working. There's a really similar concept that startups use called a handshake, where obviously you have similar shapes of problems where you need to get commitments, but it might be pre-fundraising. So you literally send an email and you'll describe the terms. You'll say, hey, this is like, it's like almost cheesy. You're like, this is Kevin from XYZ company, and I'm confirming that we had a discussion on this date and you are going to come into my company for this amount of money at this date, subject to these terms. And we're handshaking on that right now. Like, please confirm via email. And it seems a little bit cheesy, but guess what? Everyone who responds and says, yeah, I'm handshaking with you, they actually give you the money. And the people who don't say that, a lot of them don't. And so just figure out how you can make things as real as possible, even when it's not yet real. And I think that will be so helpful for you. And it will also give you feedback, because a lot of people you think are yeses will turn into noes. Yeah. And then you can figure out why. You can refine your pitch. You can talk to them and ask them what's changed, what caused that delta. And then you can become better. You can become more formidable. You can become more successful. You can increase your odds of fundraising through that iterative feedback process. It's just, maybe to sum it up, like, make things real as fast as you can. And don't come up with excuses not to do that. I think people are afraid to ask the hard questions. Say like, no, I didn't like sign an LOI, or I didn't ask like officially for sure, but like, we had a great chat, right? Think about it. You've almost certainly done that. Anyone who's listening that's, you know, done any sort of plan, you're just lying to yourself. And it's not like criticism of you. It's just like, just make it real, man.
Brilliant. Yeah. I'm a big fan of the LOI approach. It's non-letter of intent for those of you that may not know. It's non-legally binding, but there's something psychological about asking someone, click, click, here's the pen, please sign. Even if it's not legally binding, most people are like, if they really are like, no, this actually sounds pretty cool, I think I'm going to do it. Even though it's not legally binding, if they actually sign, to your point, odds are they will actually sign when your subscription documents and everything are done and the actual binding contracts get put in front of them. They're like, yeah, I've already signed one. Now I'll actually sign the real one. So I absolutely love that. So before we wrap things up, final thoughts. Is there anything else you'd like our fans around the world to know? Ways to contact you, websites to go to, anything at all?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I hope this has been helpful, first of all. And, you know, we haven't talked much about Repl, so I will take the opportunity to do the little plug. But I think a lot of managers are really happy when they launch with Repl because there are a bunch of unique things we're doing. I hope that you get some sense that we're quite competent, and we also have a much more end-to-end set of knowledge. And so we can be a much closer partner to you than some siloed single service provider that can only talk to you about a specific function whose entire support staff is offshore. We're onshore only. We're a small team, but we have brought together some of the brightest minds. Our managing director of fund admin was the chief business officer at Northern Trust for 10 years, overseeing,
that's huge,
I think, close to $1 trillion in client assets. So we've brought together a really great team. And look, in candor, we're an early stage player and we're going to hustle and be a great partner. And we're not going to work with funds that are bad because this is a real, or a bad fit rather, because this is a very reputational space. So if you are considering a serious open-ended fund launch, then we would love to chat. That's the ask. And we will work with you in any way we can. And we'll be helpful even if we can't work with you. I really believe in spreading around knowledge and success, and that worst case, it does nothing for you. But in many cases, it comes back and you get some karma type thing or whatever, right? So there's that. And then the other is, if you're an existing fund and you want to level up your back office, we'd love to chat. And we're not going to be salesy or press you on it. We'd love to get your feedback. We'd love to see if we can help you level up your LP partnership and experience. As a helpful note, we do also try and publish content that we have found and heard from people who have launched funds was hard to gain access to without talking to lawyers in other esoteric service providers. So if you go to repl.com/guides, as an example, we've posted overviews of the Investment Advisors Act, the Investment Company Act, and Securities Act of 1933, all in the context of launching a private fund, which are relevant to any private fund launch, and tried to tailor the information, writing, and scope it to what's specifically helpful for an emerging manager. So those are my plugs. Otherwise, feel free to hit me up anytime. LinkedIn, kevin@repl.com. Check us out. And then otherwise, you know, Ryan, I'm really grateful to have had the opportunity to appear on the pod. Like I said, been a longtime listener. And so finally getting a chance to spread, hopefully, even one tiny thing of all the things I've rambled about today that was helpful, I think is a pleasure. And hopefully your viewers have enjoyed some of what I've had to say today.
Perfect. So just to summarize everything, make sure that you understand the difference, 506B versus 506C, and even by extension, just understand the regulations. This is a regulated industry. Please run a clean shop and just follow the regulations and stay on top of them, because you never know. Some of them are coming out that are pretty cool that will help you. Like Kevin said, 506C is kind of a new development. It's been around a little bit, but it can help you to raise a lot of money. So stay on top of these things. The other one is test the waters. Get an LOI. Just get people to sign something. You do these things and you too will be well on your way in your pursuit of making billions.
Wow, what a show. I hope you enjoyed this episode as much as I did. Now, if you haven't done so already, be sure to leave a comment and review on new ideas and guests you want me to bring on for future episodes. Plus, why don't you head over to YouTube and see extra takes while you get to know our guests even better. And make sure to come back for our next episode, where we dive even deeper into the people, the process, and the perspectives of both investors and founders. Until then, my friends, stay hungry, focus on your goals, and keep grinding towards your dream of making billions.